Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big money on everything for your next project at Menards. Spring is here, making it the perfect time for outdoor projects. Suncast storage sheds are an excellent solution for protecting outdoor lawn and gardening tools. They're easy to assemble, and the all-weather construction provides water resistance and UV protection. Save big on Suncast storage sheds. View our selection of Suncast products today in-store and on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
You're listening to this week's excerpt from the Dear Prudence podcast. To get the full-length members-only version every week, join Slate Plus at slate.com/prudypod.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudy. Do you think that I should contact him again?
Help.
Help. Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Dear Prudence Show. My name is Mallory Ortberg, also known as your host, Dear Prudence. With me in the studio this week is Mary Goss, a comedian based in the Bay Area who is generally trying her best. Her comedy show, My Greasy Sons, is held at the Woods Bar in Oakland the first Tuesday of every month. Mary, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you so much for helping me say My Greasy Sons on the air.
People seem to be generally pretty into that name for a comedy show.
It feels so right.
Yeah.
And just given the week that we have had, the fact that just walking to the studio this morning felt like walking through a campfire, and all I want to do right now is sort of crawl inside of an old tree and fall asleep.
Yes, that feels very, very appropriate.
I'm taking my joy where I can find it. I'm really taking my joy where I can find it. Where are you taking your joy from this week?
This week I have been taking my joy from American Vandal.
I was literally about to say, if you do not know where your next bolt of joy is coming from, might I recommend the television program American Vandal? But you're already on it.
Yeah, I just finished episode 5.
Oh, God.
It's so good. They're so sweet.
For listeners who may not yet be familiar with the show that I have been yelling about nonstop on Twitter for at least the last 2 weeks, it is a television program on Netflix that is in the vein of Serial or Making a Murderer or The Jinx, and it is all about answering the question of who spray-painted dicks on 27 cars in the faculty parking lot of a high school in Oceanside, California. It is pretend. It is
yes,
scripted, but it is done in those styles, and it is the greatest thing that's ever happened to me.
Yeah, it's so, so good and so well done and so accurate.
Pure
for
joy.
High schoolers.
Oh, God. I felt like, oh, I went to high school with you. I went to high school with you. I never see you on TV, but
yes,
I know you.
Yes. It was like, if I were to come up with an alternate title for that, it would be My Greasy Sons.
Oh, it's so pitch perfect.
Yeah.
I wish so much that we could just like throw out the Dear Prudence opening intro music and just do the American Vandal intro.
Oh, it's so, so good.
And they had me at, we're going to need more than ball hairs to crack this case
yes,
open. From that moment, they had me.
It was so good. I think the opening, just everything had me immediately. But my roommate and I refer to like a very particular subset as majestic teen boys.
Mm-hmm.
And that show was full of majestic teen
such
boys.
Such dirtbags.
Yes.
And
yes,
such wonderful dirtbag girls, too.
Yes.
Like Gange.
I love her.
I love her, too. It's just true, true beauty.
Yeah.
And there's so few pure unalloyed joys in my life right now.
Yeah.
I'm really grateful for this one.
Yeah. No, that is a wonderful show. And I've been yelling about it also just to everyone who listened.
That makes me so happy. I've already ordered 2 T-shirts that appear on the show, because all I care about now is buying t-shirts from television shows I've already watched. The Carrot one.
How did you find that?
I kept Googling, like, where to buy t-shirts from American Vandal, because I really commit to things.
Yeah, of course.
And then I think a different Carrot shirt that Dylan also wore. That's just the whole goal.
I wanted to know, I haven't gotten to the end of the series, but...
I've watched it all the way through 3 times now.
I love spoilers, so is the Carrot thing ever addressed?
It is not. That's a mild enough spoiler.
Better.
Yeah, no, they never explain why he's wearing Carrot-themed shirts.
Yeah.
All right, well, now that I feel slightly centered, slightly capable of being a human being in the world, I think we should jump right into our questions. Would you be so good as to read the first letter for
us? Yes, absolutely. The subject line is co-opting tragedy. Dear Prudence, I live in Las Vegas, about half an hour from the Strip. Last Sunday night, my family and I were in the area where the shooting happened, but left to go home an hour before it began. I had some other family members at the music festival, but no one I know was injured or died. The first 24 hours after it happened, I didn't feel much of anything. Then I felt angry. Now I seem to be cycling between that emptiness, a bone-deep anger, and extreme anxiety about everything from being in public alone to going places where lots of people will be. I feel a bit out of control. And also, like, I don't have a right to be this upset, since no one I know suffered physical harm. How do I get myself back on track? I want to help people who need it instead of being so wrapped up in my fear, and more selfishly, I want to live my normal life. I can't hide at home for the rest of forever.
So I thought there were kind of two things that struck me about this letter, one of which was sort of, what do I do with all of these feelings, right? Like, I live in an overwhelming, upsetting time. I was, you know, narrowly avoided an act of terrorism that is not being called terrorism because it was committed by a white male.
Yes.
And that is, you know, additionally alienating and distressing and disorienting. And then also that kind of question of, do I have a right to feel the way that I feel? Am I taking something away from somebody else, or am I, you know, appropriating an experience that I didn't have in order to sort of center myself or make myself seem like a victim when I'm not? And I'm sort of curious about your take on both of those.
Yeah. So for the first part, I mean, There's this way of addressing tragedies like this in the media that make it just—it's just so overwhelming. This is happening constantly. Gun violence is a huge, huge issue in this country, and it can often seem like commonplace given how often it happens. Mm-hmm. So I think that that is definitely something that leads to confusion, or at least like difficulty processing these things. But the second point that you made was the one that I was thinking about more, in that people have the tendency, some people do, to like police each other's reactions to things like this. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to, you know, make it very clear to the letter writer that like their feelings are absolutely valid, and that there's nothing wrong about being understandably distressed about this huge tragedy that happened. And I mean, especially given their proximity to it, but it doesn't need to be a checklist of, like, how exactly affected were you? This is how you are allowed to process or grieve.
Right. Well, especially, too, because this letter writer, nothing they described sounded inappropriate or self-obsessed or, like, they were doing or saying anything that was, you know, taking up the space that should rightly be held by someone who is more directly affected. Like, the things you're describing, letter writer, anxiety about being in public, anger that somebody killed that many people who were just trying to go to a concert. That's a sane response.
Yeah.
That's a normal response. Of course you feel that way. Part of what you are reacting to is this insanity that there is, you want to be able to feel safe in public spaces. And right now, that's not a given.
Yeah.
So that's a completely normal response. It's not you trying to make this about you. You're not like running out here trying to, you know, grab the microphone from somebody who was injured and say, this is about me. Part of what you are responding to is, I want to feel safe in public spaces, and I don't, and we don't always feel that way. So that's really normal. So I would say, if nothing else, give yourself a lot of freedom to say, this has me shaken up. This, you know, realizing I came very close to being hurt or injured for just trying to go to a concert in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
That's awful. And so I think if you are wondering both, what do I do with these feelings? Like, one is, you got to let yourself feel them. And then another one is, figure out things that really motivate you and that you care about. And whether that's, you know, working towards more strict gun control or helping to raise money for people who were victimized. Like, this is so many different things, yeah. right? Like, the broken health insurance and healthcare systems in our country. Like, so many people are financially ruined by something like going to the hospital.
Yeah.
So if it feels helpful to you to help raise money for those people, if it helps you to try to get involved in activism, if it feels helpful to you to try to do something with these feelings so that you feel like, okay, at the very least, I am contributing to a meaningful response to acts of violence and terrorism, then you should do that.
Yeah. One of the other things I was thinking about with regards to this letter is, like, the letter writer, you know, understandably has a lot of anxiety around this. And when that happens, you can often feel paralyzed and, like, how to help, just because the tragedy is, like, at such a large level that it's hard to figure out where exactly you want to focus your energy. But there are ways to address that, or ways to try to feel like you're putting some good out into the world in response to this that, you know, could be conducive to someone who's understandably having a hard time leaving the house. Fundraising is a really good idea. The letter writer, I mean, if it's within their means, they may want to either donate to things or just make other people aware of how they can help. That research doesn't require going out into the world into large groups of people. They also may want to look into, you know, counseling for themselves, support groups. Just there's, especially in their area, there's bound to be a fair amount of resources they yeah. can be able to access to try to help process these feelings in conjunction with other people who are probably feeling the same way and maybe connected to it. At different levels.
Right. And to bear in mind, yeah, I would especially suggest if you are having a lot of difficulty leaving the house, some short-term counseling, especially that focuses on anxiety and, yeah. you know, proximity to trauma, that may prove helpful to you. And to just bear in mind, you have a right to that. Part of acts of terrorism like this, what they are designed to do is to engender fear in the general public. And you are the general public.
Yeah.
So the fact that you are having this response, if nothing else, just give yourself the freedom to say, this is an understandable response. I'm not taking away resources from other people. I'm not running into somebody else's appointment with a grief counselor and saying, right. It's my turn now.
Yeah.
You have a right to that. And I'm so sorry. And I'm really glad that you're well. I'm really glad that you're safe and that the people you care about are safe.
Yeah. If nothing else, it can be good as a reminder to kind of when you're feeling overcome by feelings of anger, anxiety, you know, what have you, completely understandable emotional responses. It could be good to remind yourself that you are incredibly lucky that given how close you were to that, that nobody you care about was, you know, injured or worse.
Right. And you shouldn't feel guilty about that.
Right.
You should feel glad.
Yes.
And I know that it's hard. There's the whole, like, survivor's remorse or just mm-hmm. being proximate to the injury and death of others. There's
yeah.
that sense of it ought to have been me. Why wasn't it me? And to just, if nothing else, to know it's good. It's good that you're okay. It's not, that's not something that you should feel wrong about. Like, the wrong came from the man who shot people.
Right.
Not from you.
Absolutely.
You did not do anything wrong by being okay.
Right.
And good luck. All right. So continuing with just real heavy hitters, would you, by the way, actually, before we jump into this one, this reminds me, there is now transcripts of the podcast available on Slate Plus, which is something that some listeners and readers have been asking me about for a while, to have transcripts of the podcast for folks who are deaf or hard of hearing. And those are now available on Slate Plus. So that's part of why it's so great to be able to take this letter.
Yeah, absolutely. Subject, how can I get my hearing family to accept me? Dear Prudence, I was born without an auditory nerve in my left ear and an underdeveloped one in the other. Despite this, I was taught to speak and do so regularly. I also know ASL. Well, my right ear has gotten worse, and I cannot hear anything anymore. I shout when I speak now, and I struggle to keep up in conversations. I lip read, but it's not very helpful. People tell me I should look into cochlear implants, corrective surgery, etc. However, after giving it some thought, I am okay with being completely deaf. I've lived most of my life as a broken hearing person, in quotes, and now I'm ready to embrace my deaf identity. This has split my family, as most of them do not sign and don't like the idea of having to text or email me all the time. My mom even thinks I'm selfish for choosing this lifestyle. So how can I get my family to accept my deaf identity?
So I think one thing that might be helpful to just mention at the top of this before we sort of dive into what we think is for people who may not be aware, there is, you know, within the deaf community, there's this concept of the capital D deaf community, which is to say like a really meaningful group of people who, in many ways, like form a group identity and have like really positive, robust ties to like their own sense of language, ways of communicating, and it's really positive. So. Just kind of a helpful context of what this person is contemplating doing. There's a lot of precedent for it.
Right.
There's a lot of support and community there. There are many, many reasons why a person might not want to undergo cochlear implants. In many ways, they're not completely helpful. They still result in needing to find other ways to communicate. So, you know, I'm also just aware, like, I am not hard of hearing, so I'm trying to think through, like, what's a useful way to talk about this? But, what this person is describing is likely something that they've given a lot of thought to, takes into account their own, like, body, their own auditory processing, their own abilities, their own strengths. And so it's not as if they are just saying, I don't want to try anything.
Right.
I don't care. Like, this is a real and a valid and a useful choice, and many, many people do it.
Yeah. And I'm also just so sorry that the letter writer's family hasn't been as sympathetic as one would hope in a situation like this, or one would expect from family members.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially because the letter writer mentions that they have been, and gosh, I apologize too. I'm not sure if hard of hearing is like the best term right now. So just that they have been living with at least like a deaf identity since they were born, that their family members, including their parents, have never learned to sign or tried to, communicate more via text or email in a way that is easier for the letter writer. I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah,
they've had a lot of time to try a little.
And it seems that there are a lot of resources that they've been unwilling to, that their family's been unwilling to really try out. I was surprised to hear that most of the family can't sign when this has been a part of the letter writer's identity for their entire life. And to react and say that, you know, electing not to get a cochlear implant is selfish. That really rubbed me the wrong way.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, not that this is your question, letter writer, because you sound already quite certain and secure that you're making a choice that is best for you. And that's great. Like, I'm glad you have that clarity.
Yeah.
So then your question is, how do I get them to accept my deaf identity? And that's challenging, right? Because in some ways, they have known about your deaf identity since birth, and their response has sort of been, well, you need to meet us on our level, and we don't need to come meet you where you are.
Yeah.
And so I think it will help to start at least with a sense of, I can't control this outcome, and I want to accept the possibility that I will ask for what I want. I will make a reasonable, convincing case that what I'm asking for is not outrageous or unduly difficult, and they might still say no.
Yeah, and that would definitely be hurtful. But one way to mitigate that, if it's within the options available to the letter writer, is look into counseling, look into resources. The National Association for the Deaf, local chapters there, see what resources they have available.
Right, because I'm sure other people who come from, like, families with people who do hear, they may also have some experience. So I would say reach out to other friends of yours in the deaf community and sort of ask, what was this like for you if you come from a family with hearing members? What's worked? What didn't? What were appropriate boundaries for you to set? Kind of ask those questions, because I think they will be even more helpful than either of us can be who are, you know, well-meaning but with no experience in that area.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I would recommend, if at all possible, to look into therapist, counselors, something like that. You know, if your family will go with you, that would be great. If not, a counselor or someone with resources.
And particularly, I think, a counselor who has experience with the deaf community.
Yeah.
Possibly even a deaf counselor, if that's something that you can find in wherever that you live. But I think your larger question is, how do I communicate where I'm coming from to my family? So I think to make it clear, I'm really comfortable being deaf.
Yeah.
You don't have to, like, go into a laundry list of justifications to your family about why you have decided against, you know, quote-unquote corrective surgery But if you feel comfortable saying, like, for X and Y reason, you know, I don't want to do that, you don't have to like that, but it is my choice. It is my body. It is the way that I process. There are, you know, knowing ASL, finding resources in the deaf community, those are all really reasonable responses to being deaf.
Yeah.
So it is not... So to just say, yeah, you don't have to love my choice, but it is my choice. It makes me really happy. It would be very meaningful to me if you would try to learn ASL, or at the very least, if you would bear like my deafness in mind and text and email me more than call, and to accept this about me, even if you don't like it. And if they don't and they can't, you know, you'll have to decide, do I want to have this conversation repeatedly? Do I want to get into a debate about it? Would I rather say, let me know when you have been able to wrap your head around this and you are willing to text me? Because you're not asking anything, you know, unduly taxing of them.
Yeah, not at all.
I love texting.
Yeah,
texting's
so
great.
Good.
I wish I could text everybody exclusively.
I do that most times when I'm home and my roommate's also home. Texting's great. But it's, yeah, I mean, one bit of context that I think would be helpful would be the time between when the letter writer came to this decision, communicated it with their family, and how long it's been since they've gotten that response, because it reads to me like this is something fairly new and there are bound to be a lot of emotional responses at the outset of something. But I would hope that, you know, with time and with the understanding that this is their own personal choice and they have their own reasons for it and they don't need to justify that to their family, hopefully with time, their family would become more accepting.
Right. Yeah. And this feels like a good time to plug if there are any readers or listeners of the show who know of any useful resources for like hearing members of deaf people, that would be sort of like a helpful sort of like intro or ways to understand. Like even something as simple as like, you know, you mentioned that you lip read, but it's not very helpful. I think sometimes people who have always had who've always been hearing think, oh, lip reading, it's that thing you do when you are deaf, and then you just can read what everyone's saying, and it's not perfect. And if someone's far away, or, you know, if they are not facing you, or or if they are mumbling, like, it's not just, like, this perfect bulletproof, like, ah, now I can just see what everyone's saying on their lips. Like, so just ways in which your family might not understand or sort of have the tools to figure out why it is you're making the choices that you are, that might be helpful. So if anybody has any recommendations, let us know, write, call, whatever, and I will plug them in the next episode. But yeah, good luck. I think for you, the most important thing is going to be deciding at what point am I willing to say, I will answer good faith questions where I think you are actually trying to learn more. But I am not going to get drawn into an argument about what surgeries I do and do not get and the ways in which I decide it is best for me to communicate.
Right, because it's clear that the letter writer came at this from like a very thoughtful, very well thought out position. It's their own personal choice, again, but it's also something that it's not like they're just, oh, I can't get the cochlear implant, so whatever, this is me now. It seems like a far more thoughtful part of their identity.
Right. Well, and that's, you know, that's part of like what people mean when they talk about ableism is this idea of, you know, I, a hearing person, am normal default. Everything I do is normal default. You need to do a lot to meet me where I am and to be quote unquote fixed. And I don't need to do anything in the other direction. I don't need to like think about reasonable accommodation. I don't need to think of you as like a viable alternative to my identity. I don't need to go out of my way to learn anything about you. And that is part of why, you know, ableism is really damaging and not good. Yeah. So good luck. Please write back. Let us know how you're doing. I hope that this choice is one that's really like good and helpful for you, and that you're able to find a lot of other people who support you and are willing to sign and text and email. I hope that you get that. All right. Another family. This is a family heavy week.
Yeah.
Families. My advice to everyone is don't have a family. spring forth from the head of Zeus fully formed.
That sounds great.
If you can.
Yeah.
Bearing a shield and a sword.
Definitely a shield and a sword.
Definitely. Okay. So this, the subject line of this one is just negotiating adopted and biological relationships. Dear Prudence, I am adopted from a foreign country, and I'm very much bonded with my adopted American family. I consider them my family, and I'm devoted to them. With their support and encouragement, I began searching for my biological relatives once I was legally able to, looking for medical background, etc. After years of searching, I successfully connected with my biological family. That whole side of the family is still together. It's been an emotional and fascinating experience that does also not negate, in any way, my deep love of my family here. My parents here are very happy and have even met my biological parents. Everyone is overjoyed. Almost. My adopted sibling, however, does not want to have anything to do with this. They don't want to meet these people, they don't want to hear about them, and the only time they have a response is to berate them. We suspect that my sibling might feel threatened, and I try to avoid talking about these things with them. But the biological family sometimes sends them gifts in an effort to make them feel included, and they mostly toss the gifts aside. I'm not sure the best way to address this with either side. I'm not much good at lying, I'm neuroatypical, and I struggle with social cues and knowing appropriate reactions to social situations. I don't want my biological family to feel bad, as they often ask if my sibling liked their gifts. I also don't want my sibling to feel bad. Should I just stop giving them the things that have been sent for them? Should I ask my biological family to stop sending things? It's a bit of a confusing situation, and it's hard to find people with the same frame of reference to ask for advice.
Talk to your sibling.
Oh, man. How would you recommend, like, do you think this is a conversation to be had where it's sort of like, I want to tell you what I need from you and I want you to do it? Or do you think it should be a sort of asking questions of the sibling, like, how are you feeling? Why are you responding the way that you're responding?
Based on what the letter writer said, I would say start with asking questions because it seems to be conjecture at this point. I'm not sure how many conversations there have been around this with the sibling directly, mm-hmm. because what the letter writer said is that they suspect that their sibling might feel threatened, but it doesn't seem like there's any direct input here from the sibling. I mean, if you want to approach it from more of a pragmatic standpoint, I feel like one of the main issues has been around gifts. Mm-hmm. So it's not written anywhere whether or not they've asked the sibling if they want these gifts, other than the sibling's kind of tepid response.
Right. That is tricky. I feel like obviously there are a lot of layers here. And one of the things that's tricky is, you know, the sibling in question is not, there's no connection to the letter writer's biological family. So I can certainly understand your sibling maybe having complicated feelings, especially if they're younger. You said you found your family after a couple years after being legally able. I don't know if your sibling is a lot younger than you. Mm-hmm. This response would maybe make sense in a 15-year-old, and it would be a little harder to understand in a 30-year-old. But I do think it can be good to ask questions. I also think it's really fair, letter writer, for you to say, I do want to know more about what feelings this has brought up for you. I also want to ask that if you cannot say anything kind about my biological family, stick with the golden rule of don't say anything at all.
Yeah. That's...
Like, you say that the only time they talk about your biological family is to berate them. And I think it is absolutely fair for you to say, I need you not to do that with me.
Yeah.
That is an ask. I am asking this of you. Please do not do this.
Yeah.
If the most you can do is forced neutrality, give me forced neutrality.
Yeah, that's a perfectly valid thing to request of your sibling because it is a very it seems to be a very fraught situation for them, and that doesn't mean that anyone's feelings are invalid, but the sibling's responses have not been that of, you know, a kind and hopeful response so far.
Right. Yeah. And letter writer, I know that you mentioned that due to being neuroatypical, you sometimes feel like you struggle with social cues or knowing the right response to a social situation. So I don't want to just say, like, just go talk to your sibling.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what that normally looks like for you and if that's fraught. I think it sounds like your parents are you have a fairly close relationship. If you think it would be helpful, you could certainly, like, try to get a little feedback from them first, like say, I want to talk to my sibling about this. I'm not quite sure how to approach it. Do you have any recommendations?
Yeah,
would it
be
helpful for
idea.
Them to be present? I don't know. But I don't think you have to avoid talking about these things with your sibling just because your sibling has been behaving, frankly, I think, badly.
Yeah.
But again, I want to bear in mind that I don't know what conversations about serious topics between the two of you often look like. So depending on what other sort of like legwork you want to do beforehand, I think it might be helpful.
Yeah, I didn't mean to sound a little overly frank at the outset.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think that ideally in a situation, if you feel comfortable enough to have that conversation, it seems that that is one of the avenues you haven't gone down yet.
Yeah.
Since you suspect that your sibling might feel threatened or things like that. It seems like there hasn't been a lot of direct input.
Right. And then I would say the other side of your problem, right, is I'm not good at lying. I don't know what to say to my biological family when they ask how my sibling responded to the gifts. And I think depending on how that conversation with your sibling goes, you could say to your biological family, and you don't have to go into the details of it all, but you could say something like, this is more challenging for them than they expected. And while I hope that someday things are different, I think it would probably be better for right now to not send them anything.
Yeah. And it sounds like you've already, you know, developed a very, you know, a close and good relationship with your biological family. So they would, I would hope, be very understanding about that request.
Right. And, it might feel a little painful for them because, of course, they just want to get to know them. They're clearly just excited to have you as a part of their life, and they want to be friendly. It doesn't sound like they're trying to, like, call your sibling and become best friends and all move in together. But it would be okay, I think, for you to say, this is tricky for my sibling. I think it would be better not to send them anything right now. I really appreciate the kindness and support that you've demonstrated by sending them gifts. Like, I understand the spirit in which it was intended, but I think for right now, what they need is space.
Right. Mentioning being neuroatypical and having difficulty with social cues, difficult conversations, things like that. Another plug for counseling, if that's within your what's available to you currently. If there's been difficulty communicating, perhaps someone who, you know, specializes in or has had experience with negotiating relationships between adoptive and biological families, that could be useful to you.
Right. Yeah. And to be clear, not in the sense of you would need this because you're a neuroatypical.
Oh, yeah.
Which is not what you were saying, I understand. Mm-hmm. But just because there are so many different levels and layers here, that if you feel like it would benefit you to have another person to bounce ideas off of, to sort of get clarity from, then that might be helpful to you, particularly if it was a therapist who was experienced working with neuroatypical clients and was not all about everybody has to respond to things in this, like, really socially normative way and you need to get on board.
Right.
Always a plug for, like, therapists who aren't just trying to make everybody, like, behave in, like, one single way, I think is useful. But, yeah, absolutely. I think you can have that conversation with your sibling. You can certainly tell your family, your biological family. I think for right now, we should lay off of the gifts.
Yeah.
And I think you could say that in a way that didn't feel like, stop it, you're jerks.
Right.
Because that's clearly not what you feel. And, you know, everything else aside, congratulations on finding your biological family and, by and large, being able to incorporate both of your families into your life in a way that sounds really lovely and loving. I'm really excited for you. That's really cool.
Yeah.
All right. Now we're getting into some more. This is just, I don't want to say fun, but I think after the heaviness of the last few, it's a little more like.
Yeah, reading this one was a bit of a relief.
It was. Yeah. Would you read it again, please?
Yeah, absolutely. The subject is Stolen. Dear Prudence, Jenny and I have been friends for several years and roommates for three. When we got introduced to John, I fell pretty fast, but Jenny beat me to the punch and asked John out first. She knew I liked him, but I downplayed how much so not to make it weird. Jenny and John dated semi-casually and he was over a lot. We hung out and it was great. Then Jenny's ex turned up and Jenny started seeing him instead. She insisted we all be friends, but John started hanging out with me instead. I asked for Jenny's blessings, and she told me she wanted me to be happy, and John was great. Jenny followed her ex when he moved, and John moved in with me, and we started dating. 2 months in, Jenny's relationship imploded, and she moved back. Only now she's bad-mouthing me to anyone with ears. She says I stole John, sabotaged her relationship to get him, and friends don't date friends' exes. I feel like I have been punched in the gut. I don't know what or if I should talk to Jenny. This is so incredibly unlike her, I thought her Facebook got hacked until mutual friends told me. To make it more awkward, we both work in the same small industry and will run into each other professionally.
So this is straight up a Paramore song?
Yes.
This was like a very popular Paramore song like 8 years ago, and that's just really wonderful.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not wonderful. It sounds unpleasant for you, but...
Yeah, it doesn't sound great.
It's adorable.
Yeah.
Jenny's an asshole. Jenny's an asshole who is making up nonsense rules.
Yes, that is perfectly valid. You asked her for her blessings. She gave them. You can't take backsies on blessings.
You also, if you dated somebody for 2 months and then you got together with your ex, you don't... Mm-hmm. I think it's weird to have rules about who your friends can and can't date based on either crushes or very brief relationships. I could certainly understand why someone would feel like this person I dated for 3 years and felt really strongly about, if you guys started dating, would be really difficult for me. That is not this situation.
Yeah, but in that vein, the letter writer can't have it both ways because they made sure to mention that they had a crush on John first.
Yeah, that's the other thing too, right? Like, I think obviously, like, you obviously handled that a lot better than she did. You just kind of felt sad. Mm-hmm. But yeah, if you have a crush on someone and you don't ask them out and somebody else asks them out, that's okay.
Yeah, and it didn't seem that they were going back on that or was trying to use that as an excuse. It was just a funny thing to mention when the moral of this should be stop, trying to just control all of your friends' relationships and whether or not they have them.
Yeah. You and John are dating. He sounds, frankly, like a little ping pong ball who gets, like, passed around between the two of you. No, I'm sorry. I don't mean to say passed around in a way that's, like, demeaning. I just mean, like, the two of you seem to be sort of working out some sort of, like, psychosexual rivalry through John, and that's funny.
Try a thruple.
Oh, boy. Can you imagine how bad that threesome would be?
That would be so bad.
It would be it would either be a nightmare or incredible. And then a nightmare, obviously.
I think some combination of both probably... Oh, gosh.
Don't have a threesome, but if you do, please write back and let us know how it was.
I'm also just curious about several things in this letter. When I started reading it, I had assumed that they were all in undergrad. And then now they're talking about working in the same small industry. So I'm just like, how old are these people? What are you up to?
Oh, my guess is like early mid-20s.
Yeah, it feels like that to me, too. And also, so John moved in and then you started dating. There's just so much I want to know about
this.
Yeah,
that's total early 20s. Like, this is...
I want to date all my roommates and their exes, you know.
Oh, man. Every time 20s. I've ever known someone who started dating one of their roommates.
It's always...
It's amazing. It's always been...
It's always so dramatic and
so
wonderful.
Much. Yeah. So, but the good news is here, sometimes when somebody acts really outrageously, our response will be, I must have done something wrong. Otherwise, this person would not be going off like this. And actually... Jenny is just being awful, and you don't have to do a thing about it. Like, if she wants to run around yelling to anyone who will listen that you stole her boyfriend, that's not worth addressing or engaging in.
It's not.
It's just so not reality.
John's a person who made his own choices, too.
Right. Yeah.
Nobody stole anyone. And also, one of the things that I found, I don't even know if it would be helpful in this situation, but one of my secret power moves is just to speak about bad behavior while it's happening.
Yeah.
If Jenny's saying some BS to you, to your face, which doesn't sound to be the case, but just in case she starts.
On Facebook. Oh, boy. That's what made me think, like, wait, are they 16? Like,
yeah. But no, 16-year-olds don't use Facebook anymore.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm. No, fair. You're right. Mm-hmm. Time marches on.
Yeah. No, maybe something in a Snapchat story.
But. Maybe. Jenny is being very, and that's the thing too, like anybody who is listening to her is kind of aware that she is being wildly unreasonable.
Yeah.
There's just, Jenny's not a good friend.
Yeah, just try to keep it civil and maybe don't try to talk to Jenny about your relationship in case you thought that that was a good idea.
Yeah, I don't know how worth it would be trying to have a conversation with Jenny. If she does or says something really outrageous and you want to say, hey, you should knock this off. You should find a better outlet for your aggression. This is ridiculous. You can do that.
Yeah.
The friendship is not salvageable.
Mm-mm.
The things that she has done and said from going from, it's great that you guys are dating, to, oh no, my boyfriend and I broke up. You're a monster. I'm going to yell at you on the internet. That's not the act of a good friend who made a mistake or an error in judgment. That's the act of a bad friend who considers you totally disposable based on how she feels about herself and her own relationship on any given moment.
Yep.
She's a bad dude. I'm sorry that you found out this way. I hope John is really fun to date. And you should just feel really free to, I mean, you know, you get to mourn the friendship.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's sad when someone you thought you cared about turns out to be a lousy person who's a jerk.
Mm-hmm.
But there's nothing for you to, like, look back on and say, should I have done this differently? There's nothing for you to say. How could I have brought this upon myself? Is there a good person somewhere hiding inside of Jenny that I can reach through the power of, like, reasonable conversation?
Yeah, it could just take time for her to stop bad-mouthing. You know, I'm not saying she's going to radically change her entire personality right now.
Yeah, you didn't. You can't steal people.
Nope.
You didn't steal John. I don't know how she thinks you could have sabotaged her relationship to get him, but just, you know, send her the Paramore song.
Yeah.
Don't send her the Paramore song. She will, like, slash your tires if you do that. But
yeah, but you could play it really, really loudly.
Oh, my goodness. It's such a great song for just feeling really like, oh,
yeah,
I got mine.
Yeah.
And you're the worst.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, no, you're fine. You're doing great. Your friend is bad.
Yeah.
All right. This next one, this last one, Married into Money. Dear Prudence, I work at a nonprofit for those suffering from food instability, and my family and I have a simple but comfortable lifestyle. My brother-in-law and I have been good friends since my husband and I started dating. My brother-in-law recently got married, and we were so excited for him. But his new wife comes from an extremely wealthy family. Now he and his wife have not been working, and they've been taking a year of vacationing at the top resorts throughout the world. Every time I talk to them, they talk about their new things, their growing inheritance, their philanthropy seminars, and their vacations. They also love sending video messages from exotic places. I'm not sure if it is jealousy from our modest lifestyle or the nature of my work, but hearing from them makes me sick and angry. How can they brag about philanthropy and live like the 1%? My brother-in-law wants to know what happened and why I don't like his new wife. Is there a kind way to explain the situation, or is this something better left unsaid?
My take is that this is something better left unsaid and something the letter writer probably needs to work out for themselves. Alternately, they should think about if it were not something they wanted to leave unsaid, what is the result they would want from a conversation about that?
Right. How would that conversation go?
Yeah.
What would be a good outcome?
I can't
think of any.
Yeah, I can't think of anything
other. I think, letter writer, I'm not totally unsympathetic to where you're coming from. I think the idea of, like, attending philanthropy seminars at, like, top-notch resorts is kind of a bullshit way to convince yourself that spending a lot of money is giving back, sort of like in the way that sometimes people who run companies are like, I make jobs, as if that weren't the point of your company, as if it were like an act of kindness.
Yeah. I employ people. All right.
Yeah.
Congrats.
Yeah. That's not an act of goodwill, Scrooge McDuck. Yeah. So I would say my best advice for you is keep your eye on your own page.
Yeah, that's a good point. And because of your experience working in nonprofits with, you know, philanthropic efforts, if you feel that they're not directing their philanthropic efforts in the right way, you could at least, you know, talk to your brother-in-law about where you, in your personal experience, have seen need and things that they might find helpful.
Absolutely. Like, I think the best way, because, you know, your two options are not either say, brother-in-law, I used to like you, but I think your wife is shallow and making you shallow, and now you're bad people.
Yeah.
I don't think that's going to be a good conversation. Mm-hmm. But neither do I think that you should only say, this is pure jealousy and pettiness on my part, and I need to just forget about it and pretend those feelings don't exist. Because obviously that's not working, right? Your brother-in-law's already noticed.
Yeah.
You have been unable to mask your dislike. And so I think for you to, like, if you want to talk about the work that you find meaningful, like, meet them where they're at. You're like, I know you guys are really interested in philanthropy. Here's a program that I'm working on right now that I think is really wonderful. I'd love to tell you more about it. Like, if nothing else, just share more stuff about your own life.
Instead of trying to make them not share theirs.
Yeah. And I get it. Some of that does sound frustrating. I certainly, if I had a relative who went from being like in one sort of like social economic background and all of a sudden shot up to I don't work anymore and I'm taking a year off to travel, I'm sure I would feel feelings about that. And some of those feelings would rhyme with schmellacy and schmustration.
Yeah.
So I get it. And it doesn't, it's not just pettiness that you're feeling this way. But I also think there's just no way I can see a productive, helpful conversation coming out of, I don't like the way you and your wife spend your money.
Yeah. Like, that's kind of what struck me the most, is that they're
especially because he's your brother-in-law.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, he's your husband's relative. He's not your brother. Which even then I wouldn't say would be like, yep, go ahead, have that like drag down knockout conversation. Like,
yeah, maybe try talking to your husband more about it, how you're feeling, because I don't know anything about how your husband feels.
Yeah, if you need to like take a break from looking at their video messages from an infinity pool, that's totally understandable. If you need to like mute them on Instagram or wherever, I don't even know if you can mute people on Instagram. Do what you got to do. Like, don't surround yourself with like video representations of how high on the hog they're living. That's absolutely okay.
Yeah, if you want to vent. Just maybe not to them directly.
Yeah. Vent to a therapist. And I would say vent appropriately to your husband, because, again, that's his brother. He may not have the same response that you do. Please do bear in mind that, like, as cool and as meaningful as your work and your life with your family sounds, that doesn't make you the arbiter of how other people spend their money.
Yeah.
And it's just always better in those moments when those decisions come up to just kind of remind yourself, I cannot control how they spend their money. I'm going to let that one go. I have no control over that. All I can focus on is the work that I care about and my own family.
Yeah.
And then, you know, when it comes to talking to them, if it feels like the conversation really gets dominated by, like, whatever new, like, toy they have acquired or trip they are going to take, it is absolutely okay to say, like, oh, I really want to tell you about something that I did recently, or I'm really excited about this. Like, you get to be a participant in the conversation and not just a passive, resentful receiver of, like, laundry lists of purchase items.
Yeah, because that's just going to lead to the letter writer stewing and venting at a very inappropriate time.
Yep. And so I would say, you know, your brother-in-law has asked what has happened and why you don't like his new wife. So clearly,
something's already up.
You have let it be known that things are different between the two of you and that it has to do with his wife, which I think is probably not good. Like, again, unless you were, like, a bad person, that's not what you want. You don't want, I think one of the worst outcomes is you don't really say anything, but you make it really clear that you don't like them anymore. And there's just this new wedge between you.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to talk to your brother-in-law, you don't need to make it about his wife, about how they're spending their money. You could just be honest and say, like, you know, I've been going through some stuff lately, just about feelings where money's concerned. So it might be useful to apologize for giving such a negative reaction to his wife and their life.
Right. Because, again, some of your feelings are legitimate, but your response is not the best possible response to those legitimate feelings. So I think it actually would be okay. Again, depending on how close the two of you are, I would check in with your husband first, because, again, that's his side of the family. It's always good to check in with the person who's related to the people before you go forth with some new aspect of your relationship. And you don't have to go into great detail. You don't have to, like, bare your soul, but you can just say, you know what? I hear that. I know I've been a little bit distant lately. I have been going through a lot with my own feelings. And I really apologize that translates into my being cold and distant, because that's not what I want to be with you. I love you. I care about you. I'm so glad that you're happy, because you can be, letter writer. Like, you don't have to like his new wife to say, I am happy that you found someone you're happy with.
Right.
And you're not, that doesn't mean you have to pretend to love all of their choices or want all of their choices for yourself, but that's not something you have to do. You don't have to worry about that. And so I think to just say, like, you're right, and I'm sorry, and I don't want to do that, and I do miss our closeness. And again, that doesn't mean you have to, like, talk on the phone for an hour every day.
Yeah.
But I do think it would be appropriate to acknowledge that he is right when he says you have seemed distant and all that, and to just say, I want to do better. And to remember, it is not always appropriate to share all of your thoughts and feelings about how he spends his money with him. If it's really hard for you, talk to a therapist, talk to a friend, talk to somebody else. Filter before you share with him.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
Because it's just, what good can come of it?
Yeah, that was my initial response. It's just that clearly this is something that's been gnawing at the letter writer for quite some time, but it doesn't seem like anything productive would come of that conversation if they were to have it.
Yep. I would say at most you can acknowledge that there's been a little bit of a distance, and say that you are working on it and you want to do differently and you really do care about him and you really are happy for him, and let that be that.
Yeah.
And then if future conversations get really dominated by their massive new purchases, it is okay to either say, hey, can we talk about something else for a little while? Mm-hmm. Or to say, hey, if you're interested in philanthropy, I know this really cool project that some friends of mine are working on. You might want to check it out. Or to just say, like, I love you. I hope you're having a great time. Gotta go. Yeah. Like, you can say neutral things that are just like, you sound really happy. I'm so glad to hear that. Yeah. And that is true. And that is not like co-signing all of their choices. It's just falls under the great umbrella of lots of times our relatives make choices that we don't think are great, but that are not necessarily like actively harmful in the worst and yeah. don't require our constant input.
Yes.
I think just the like operating principle you should go with in this is it is always better to err on the side of, you know, positive neutrality.
Yeah.
When it comes to relatives and money. Yeah. That's not to say that there aren't definitely at times when, like, you need to speak up if someone in your family is doing something that you believe to be wrong. I don't think this falls under that category.
No, it doesn't. I mean, I think it would just be good for the letter writer to hopefully focus on their own life, their own feelings, their own relationship with money, especially, so that they don't get to the point where they're, you know, calling their brother-in-law's wife money bags behind her back.
Yeah, yeah. Do not draw her into your next Scrooge McDuck cartoon.
Yeah.
Or whatever it is that you're doing. And good luck.
Yeah, good luck.
Oh, all right. That was a heavy week.
Yes.
We did it.
We did. I am very glad that we did.
I am too. I think we've both earned ourselves at least one episode of American Vandal this afternoon. Oh, I'm just thinking about that makes me so happy.
I'm so excited to watch the last couple.
I just want to crawl into a cave and make a nest and just watch TV there for the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm. I would probably want to be in a hut near the ocean.
Perfectly understandable.
Yeah.
Perfectly understandable. I'll absolutely allow that. That totally falls under the rubric of the new way that we live.
Good, 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 good.
Thank you so much for your lovely advice.
Thank you so much for having me.
It was just terrific, and I hope that we get to have you back again soon.
Yay.
Thanks for listening to Dear Prudence. Our producer is Audrey Dilling. Our theme music was composed by Robin Hilton. Don't miss an episode of the show. Head to slate.com/dearprudence to subscribe. If you want me to answer your question, call me and leave a message at 401-371-DEAR, that's 3327, and you might hear your answer on an episode of the show. You don't have to use your real name or location, and at your request, we can even alter the sound of your voice. Keep it short, 30 seconds, a minute, tops. You already listen to podcasts, but there isn't much quality audio for your kids. Pinna is a safe, ad-free, guilt-free audio entertainment app just for kids. Pinna has programs for kids from 4 to 12, but parents will enjoy it too. It's perfect for car time, bath time, group time, bedtime, or anytime. Try Pinna for free. Go to pinna.fm/listen to start your free trial today.